Good afternoon. I'd like to call the Job Growth, Energy, and Affordability Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Monday, April 11th, and we do have a quorum present. I think we're going to start with Representative Albright. Since he is in the room, he gets bonus points. Afternoon, Representative Albright. Representative Szymanski, would you like to move his bill? It's going to be laid over. Representative Szymanski moves Representative Albright's bill, House File 3575, to be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. I believe you have an amendment, the A1.
I do. Okay. Madam Chair, the A1.
I will move the A1 amendment. Would you like to speak to the amendment, or would you like to include it in your bill and talk to the bill as a whole?
No, actually, this is the A1 amendment actually comports to the activities and the resolution of a couple of constituencies over on the Senate side, and so we're taking up the language that already has passed through committee on the Senate side so that we streamline the process as we move forward.
Okay. Any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A1 amendment has adopted. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this is a bill that actually dates back to sections of the state statute from a number of years ago in 1970s, to be specific, where the all-consuming issue at the time was about energy conservation. In light of that practice, but going forward to today, in terms of development with particular emphasis on where you have both public-private partnerships that relate to business and or developments in general, it no longer works. And so 3575, as it has been amended, actually goes to the heart of that point and actually straightens out the code so that business development can move forward in a more straightforward and business-like manner. And I have a testifier that can elaborate on the bill and how it's important to development in the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Testifier, can you state your name for the record, please, and continue with your testimony?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm sorry, my throat's a little bit hoarse today, but my name is Joe Sullivan. I'm with the Center for Energy and Environment. I'm actually not, we're not pursuing this legislation, but we've worked with the author and Kelly Doran, who's working on the bill primarily. And Kelly Doran, the reason that he's brought the bill forth is he's working on a development for, it's a mixed-use development, both residential and public. And the way that the reason for the legislation is because in state law, it is prohibited to heat a public parking ramp. And there are good public policy reasons for that. But we've always been able to heat private parking ramps. What Mr. Doran is proposing to build, it's a residential, mixed residential commercial facility that will be serving the Southwest Corridor. It's basically like a park and ride. But the building is a residential unit on floors 2 through 4. It's a public parking facility on the first floor, and then there's a private parking ramp in the basement. And the reason that the building, the public parking facility needs to be heated is because the private parking ramp will be heated below, and then the residential units will be heated above. And if you don't heat the facility, or you don't heat the public facility, you'd have a lot of condensation and moisture issues. So to get around that, they would need to spend several million dollars, which would be, to my knowledge, these would be state dollars because it would be paying for the public structure. And that was the fact situation that I just sketched out there is not what the original statutory, the 40-year-old statutory language was anticipating. So what we worked on, the Center for Energy and Environment, we worked with the Department of Commerce on this, and we worked with some other folks, was a provision that would basically allow for the moving forward. It would bring some flexibility to a new type of structure. that wasn't originally envisioned. And our concerns in the amendment have been met. And what we're, what you would allow, what it, the, what it would basically allow you to do is move forward on the building and have some minimal heating in the public ramp. And with that, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Representative Wagenis, do you have a question?
I do. Thank you. I get the problem you're addressing, but the bill addresses everything. I mean, it changes the law for everything and everybody. And in this case, when it says all appropriate energy efficiency measures have been considered, somebody could say, well, I considered everything and I rejected it. And so the commissioner then had to, would have to grant an exception. Am I right about that?
Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Wagenis. Yes, the amendment as the bill has now been tailored allows for the Commissioner of Commerce to review the information provided to him or her and with that offer an exemption for a structure on a permit-by-permit basis.
Representative Wagenis.
But I am when you say may grant, it means that if somebody has done all these things, then does the commissioner have to grant it once each one of these things have been done, or does the commissioner actually have discretion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenis, that is exactly why we included the word may as opposed to shall.
Okay.
It is permissive but not obligatory.
Thank you.
Okay, any other member questions? Representative Mahoney.
The idea of heating a public, a commercial parking space for the reasons that you stated is fine with me. My worry is that somebody's going to come along and say, have you filed an EIS on this use of heat? So you might want to think about that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney will take that under serious consideration. Thank you for that observation.
Okay, any other member questions? Otherwise, we'll go to more public testimony. Seeing none, this is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public that would like to testify for or speak against the bill? Okay, seeing none. And I don't believe have any other member questions. Representative Albright, any final words?
No, ma'am, I do not.
Okay. Representative Swedinski renews his motion that House Bill 3575, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Chair and members.
Representative Knobloch, you are here now, so let's bring you down. Representative Knobloch, I will move House File 2012 to be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I have a small oral amendment I'd like if we could, too, and that would be on page 1, line 10. Delete the rest of the words after the word blind up to the period on page 1, line 11. I guess I've learned that the adjustment to blindness centers aren't in every location, so it's not really a appropriate thing to have in the bill. So if you could just move that oral amendment.
Representative Knobloch, could you repeat that for staff so make sure we
sure.
get that oral amendment?
Page 1, line 10, put a period after the word blind and delete the rest of the sentence.
Does that carry on to line 1.11?
It does.
Okay. Staff, do we have that correction? Okay. Is there any discussion to that oral amendment? Okay. Seeing none, all in favor of the oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2012 appropriates funds for state services to the blind. with the aging of society, blindness for senior citizens is becoming an increasing problem. And this bill is meant to deal with some of those issues. And I have here with me Jennifer Dunham, who is here to testify on behalf of the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Dunham, and I serve as president of the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota. We are all well aware of the impending increase in the number of Minnesotans who will become senior citizens during the next 5 years or so. What is not quite always as obvious, though, is that because seniors have a higher rate of vision loss, the number of seniors who are going to be experiencing vision loss will increase at a significantly higher rate. Those of us who have been advocates for blind people have all met people who are in nursing homes who were placed there only because they did not know how to live independently any longer after they'd lost their sight. This is wrong, and these kind of things will continue to happen. They'll increase dramatically until we take action. The decision to move from the home where one's lived independently and live in a nursing home or assisted living facility is too often made without knowledge or hope. Both knowledge and hope can be imparted by training and guidance from those who teach the necessary skills and techniques that allow a blind person to live independently. The trends tell us that within 5 years, there'll be over 1 million Minnesotans who will be over the age of 74 years of age, and 50,000 of those will be experiencing some form of vision loss. Clearly, if we extend those numbers to include people over 65, then the estimates will increase. Allowing people to move from their homes into more expensive living situations sooner rather than later is it means that individuals will be more likely to exhaust their financial cushion, and they've worked for so long, and that means that the state will be paying for those things. So let me just explain a little bit what happens to seniors now. The Senior Services Unit of Minnesota State Services for the Blind, which is within the Department of Employment and Economic Development, already has a considerable background working with senior citizens who are experiencing vision loss. Unfortunately, the funding is very minimal even now. During fiscal year 2014, their programs touched the lives of about 3,000 seniors, and in the last fiscal year, there was a 25% increase in the number of people that they were asked to serve. The signs indicate that the trend will continue. There's long waiting times to receive services. SSB, State Services for the Blind, has not received an appropriation increase in about 17 years, aside from cost of living adjustments. And so sometimes things like providing just saying, here's a magnifier, here's how you use your magnifier, and going on is what has to happen, when really that's not an appropriate thing for example, learning how to cook. If you need to know how to cook without seeing, you're not going to be wanting to put your face up by the stove. You need to learn the techniques for how to mark it tactually so that you can feel it, etc. So adjustment to blindness services mostly are funded by federal funding for vocational rehabilitation, but this is not the case for people who are seeking employment such as most seniors. The Senior Services Unit, together with an established network of service providers, is the only meaningful source of help and funding, and the funding is minimal. And so by increasing this funding, more people will be able to be reached, more training will be able to be provided in their homes, either in their homes or in group class settings, which are currently available through the established network of training centers and vendors. The three training centers that exist in Minnesota can be used to provide hope, and we want to ensure that Minnesota's dollars are invested wisely, scale up the programs that are going to be needed as the number of seniors increase, and make sure that our dollars are used in a wise fashion. So urge your support for this legislation.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Knobloch, do you have any other invited testifiers today?
No, I do not, Madam Chair.
Right, we'll move to any member questions. And any members of the public wish to testify for or against the bill? Okay, seeing none from the public, and I'm sorry, did we have a question on this side? No? Okay. I don't see any other member questions. Any final words, Representative Knobloch?
No, other than I appreciate the hearing and urge you to consider the bill.
Thank you. And with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 2012 be laid out for possible inclusion in a later bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Knopfler. Representative Clark, would you like to present your bill? Representative Clark, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I'd like to move House File 3258.
Okay, Representative Clark moves House File 3258 to be laid out for possible inclusion in a later bill. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this is a bill that modifies some of the requirements for the Family Homeless Prevention Assistance Program, which, by the way, is a program that's been around, Anderson, since about 1993 under Governor Carlson. And I have Mr. Pinkel here, who's here from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, who'd like to run through it a bit, and then I have one other witness.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Katie Topinka, Legislative Director at the Housing Finance Agency. This bill is a small policy bill. We have to make a couple of small changes to the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program. As Representative Clark mentioned, this program's been in existence since about 1993. It provides flexible grants to counties and nonprofit organizations to assist families, single adults, or youth who are homeless or at imminent risk of homelessness. We currently fund 19 grantees that serve people in all 87 counties, and funds are used for a broad range of activities aimed at homelessness prevention, minimizing episodes of homelessness, and eliminating repeat episodes of homelessness. Grantees provide services that may include financial assistance, such as a security deposit, short-term rental assistance, or assistance with a mortgage payment. And grantees may also provide referrals for social services or for finding rental housing. What this bill does is change the homeless youth definition in the statute from 22 and under to 24 and under. This change was recommended by our program staff in order to bring this statute in line with other federal definitions and the state definition under the Homeless Youth Act, which is a program that the Department of Human Services administers. This change will not change the number of persons served under the program because people ages 23 and 24 are already being served as single adults, but it may change the way that those people are served to have more appropriate services for homeless youth. The second change is the bill makes tribes eligible applicants for the program. And currently, tribes are eligible to apply for other agency programs, and other state agencies have recently made changes to allow tribes to be eligible applicants. Received an endorsement from the Tribal Homelessness Collaborative to be added as eligible applicants. And there are high rate of homelessness on tribal land, so we think this change would allow tribes to provide appropriate services to their members. So that's what the bill does. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Pinkett. Are there any member questions? Okay, seeing none, are there any members of the public that would like to testify for or against the bill? Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm the Executive Director of MICA, the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, and have a little information for you, as well as the President and CEO of Integrated Community Solutions. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill. As a person that's worked on housing and homelessness for over 45 years in this state, and as a provider of Elam Transitional Housing, where we actually administered this program for 20 years, I want to thank you for continuing to support this bill, and we support the changes in this bill to bring it in conformity with the federal definition in regards to youth and our other state programs serving youth, as well as clarifying what we believed when we passed this bill in 1993, that the tribes were included in this bill. So we think that this is very important. We think that it's critically important that prevention is the key way that we address people becoming homeless, as well as making sure that we have enough affordable housing. Right now, 1 in 8 households in Minnesota pay more than 50% of their income for housing. When you pay that much money for housing, then you're always at risk of experiencing homelessness. And I do have a fact sheet that I will give to Representative Clark to add into the testimony. Some of the ways that we can address in preventing homelessness very quickly is by making sure that people have livable incomes. And one of those incomes that the governor has moved forward at a limited amount is on the Minnesota Family Investment Program. We have not increased that program for people, families that are on public assistance since 1986. If we would double that grant, we would significantly reduce the number of families in shelters or needing the Family Homeless Prevention Program. And I also have a piece that shows the difference between what housing costs were in 1986, and I have been running programs since the early 80s, and now housing costs here and what the grant is. So when you don't have enough money to afford housing, the chances are you are going to end up becoming homeless. So we strongly support the bill and encourage you to move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any member questions for this testifier? Okay, seeing none, any other members of the public like to testify for or against the bill? Okay. Seeing none, would you like to renew your motion, or do you have anything?
Madam Chair, I do renew this motion for 3258 to be passed and go into the omnibus bill. Laid over for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill, I believe is the correct wording.
Representative Clark renews her motion for House File 3258 be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, thank Representative you. Clark. Okay. They just stepped out.
All right, next bill up today is House File 2995, Representative O'Neill. Representative O'Neill will move it for possible inclusion. Is that what it is? Laying over. Okay, possible inclusion for a future bill.
Yes.
Representative O'Neill, to your bill, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I have an oral amendment to this bill. If I could put this bill in the shape I would like. And you have something in your packets from the Department of Labor and Industry to that to that amendment. This bill is in on page 5 to line 29 through 30. This is putting it into federal conformity. There was an error in drafting. So this is just a drafting error, and it needs to be put in the correct format so we're in compliance with federal standards. And I believe you have this in the packet. Would you like me to read the oral amendment as well?
Yes, Representative O'Neill, if you could repeat, what was the line again that it's on the that we're looking at here?
We're on page 5, line 29 through 30, so 5.29 through 5.30.
Okay. Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With
if you would strike lead pipe and comma, make solder a capital S. After the word containing, add not to go on to more. Strike 0.25% lead, and then the remaining is added language. Should read right after the word then, after we just struck that, a weighted average of 0.25% lead when used with respect to the wetted surfaces of pipe, comma, pipe fittings, comma, plumbing fittings, comma, and fixtures.
Okay, hold on a second. Let's if we could start from solders with a capital S again, and just go through that line.
Okay.
I have it as solders and flux containing not more than. Is that correct or not than? Not more than?
Is that the amendment?
Okay.
Let's do this. We have the.
Oh, we actually have the amendment. Pass it up. Okay. Hang on 1 second, folks. We'll get this passed around to the committee.
That
That would be better.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Newman. Okay, so I'll just wait until you all have that in front of you.
Thank you. And then we'll just move that amendment when we've got to have it in front of everybody.
Again, that is conforming to federal regulation and making sure that that drafting error is corrected. I would actually like to have my testifier speak to the bill, to the substance of the bill, as it is a Dolly agency bill.
Okay.
Would you like me to...
Let's move the amendment first, if I could, please. Everybody has a copy. If I could, I'll go ahead and see if there's any questions on that. If there's any questions in the amendment, members, I think we'll go ahead and proceed. Just move the A16 amendment to the bill so the author can accept it and carry on. Any comments from members? Hearing no comments, all those in favor with the A16 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Amendment has been carried. And to your bill, then, Representative Wynn.
Mr. Chair, again, I would like to have the testifier from Dolly come to speak to the specific changes within the housekeeping bill.
Very good. Thank you. And welcome, testifier.
Chair and members of the committee, I'm John Rakowski with the Department of Labor and Industry, before you today with the department's cleanup bill, or housekeeping bill, as it's called. These changes that you see in front of you are needed provide as much clarity as possible for the agency employees and members of the public who are responsible for interpreting the meaning of these statutes and rules as part of their job. As many of you know, through our agency overviews, we've explained that we license over 110,000 individuals and businesses in the state in the various areas of construction mostly, but other areas as well. And what we put together and these paragraphs mean a lot to their occupation, so it is important, although these are minor changes. Sections 1 and 2 are related to Chapter 184, which is the employment statute. In our housekeeping bill from last year, we eliminated the requirement that fee-based employment agencies in Minnesota, of which there are two, pay us a license fee. We need to update these statutes to reflect this repeal by deleting obsolete references. Sections 3 all the way down to section 24 fall under the what's called the Construction Code Statute 326B. And that's where obviously the meat is of this bill, is contained of this bill. Section 3, I'll point out, as I said, we license thousands of people. Obviously, sometimes we get incomplete license applications. Right now, our licensed folks are required to issue a licensing order, which is time-consuming and, frankly, a little too heavy-handed for the consumer or the license holder. This makes a licensing order not a requirement to continue with your license application. Section 4, and you can feel free to stop me at any point. Otherwise, I'll just run through these sections by sections real quickly. Section 4 has to deal, this is an issue the committee dealt with last year regarding the rollout of the state building code to 270 days prior to it taking effect. This also includes what the Board of Electricity, the High Pressure Piping Board, and the Board of Plumbing, which are kind of under our purview at the department. They were omitted last year. Section 5 changes our continuing education term units, which is less than 1 hour, 60 minutes, 2 hours, to conform with other CCLD, construction code and licensing license types. As many of you know, including Representative Mahoney, as part of your requirement to hold that license, you're required to take continuing education classes. And so we'll now refer to those as hours, not units. Sections 6 through 9 date back to some obsolete language of about 3 years ago. We split the elevator license from the electrical license statute to give it its own license. That was done in statute. We're eliminating the rule here, which is also referenced in Section 26 of the bill. So that has to do with elevator constructors. That was Section 6 through 9. Section 10 is the lead pipe issue that the EPA passed a rule in 2014, which we just discussed, and you passed that amendment just now with the language that was needed. Section 11 deals with water and sewer installations. This was a housekeeping bill from last year at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. If you lay pipe for a living, you're required to get a bond both from Dolly and from MPCA. Now we're saying you only need to file one bond. Let's see. Section 12 deals with journey worker plumber licenses and the date in which they expire. We're making that consistent with practice. And last but not least, Section 13 through 24, which is many, many pages, and that deals with the high-pressure pipe fitter contracting license. We're changing that to a master high-pressure pipe fitter wherever it's referenced in statute, so it's consistent with the other master licenses. And again, I'm sure Representative Mahoney appreciates that consistency. Okay, moving on to my final sections. 25 deals with the competitive sports statute. This change clarifies that license fees for boxing and mixed martial arts promoters, their license fees are due to us at least 6 weeks prior to the contest. Sometimes that doesn't always happen with these promoters. I won't get into the reasons why. It also states that other license fees shall be paid no later than the weigh-ins prior to the event. Typically, that's 24 hours the day of. We ran into this glitch last year, Representative Baker, where we were requiring them to pay 48 hours, and that's before the weigh-in, and the promoters and the combatants were saying, I just made weight. I need to get a corner person. I'm going to call my friend Marion here to be my corner that day. Only until I make weight do I know that I'm going to be in the ring. Therefore, do I need a corner person to be licensed? So we made that change to accommodate him.
Yeah, Mr. Rakowski, I'm kind of surprised you missed that on the martial arts bill last year that I carried. So I'm glad you caught that now.
It actually came up from a promoter who said this hasn't worked.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay.
So they do read the statutes.
Please proceed. Yeah, that's good.
We can do this much.
Okay, I see we have another amendment before the committee.
Right, was that all you had so far? I was going to ask the author, Representative
Mahoney. That's my overview. That concludes my overview of any questions you may have.
And Representative O'Neill, we do have another amendment here, too, kind of another housekeeping. You want to include this as well?
Yes, the A16, if we could.
Okay. So in front of you, members, we have another amendment, A16-0994. I think it's in front of the members now. We'll take any questions. Otherwise, again, we'll...
The testifier would like to speak to the amendment.
Sure. Let's go ahead and do that, Mr. Rakowski.
Thank you very much. This language came to our attention just a few weeks ago. It's some clarifying language between an employee and an employer as to clarifying that the employer and the employer are in agreement whenever I agree as an employee to have automatic charitable deductions withdrawn from my payroll.
Okay.
And Representative O'Neill is my employer. The two of us would have to equally consent to that. It's already law. This is just clarifying language.
Okay.
It's for charitable organizations, 501Cs. And I did have a letter from the United Way organization supporting these voluntary payroll deductions. I apologize that wasn't in your packet. I thought it was.
Thank you for that clarification. And you'd like to move that amendment as well, Representative O'Neill.
I would like to move the A16 to be adopted to get the bill in the shape I would like.
Okay. Further comments from the members at the table? Oh, one moment, please. Yeah, we want to clarify this amendment has the same front numbers as the other one. So this is the amendment A16-0994 for the record. Correct? Okay. Seeing no members from the questions from the members to the amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That amendment is also included. Any other testimony from you, Mr. Rakowski? Any more clarification? Is there anybody? Is the bill now in the form that you'd like it to have, Representative O'Neill?
Yes, Chair.
Members of the audience, is there anybody here to speak in favor of or opposition of the bill or the housekeeping language that has been presented? Hearing and seeing none, we'll close the public testimony. Back to the table. Members, any questions for the testifier or the author? Representative O'Neill, final comments to your bill.
Just would like to move it and continue on.
Very good. Thank you so much for your time today. Our members, we're going to include this with the possible inclusion with the future bill. So again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all there is to it. Thank you.
All right.
Representative Neuberger is up for House File 2817. Back over? Okay. Our final bill now. A couple more, okay. Clean this up a little bit here. All right. Representative Neuberger moves his 2817 House file for possible inclusion in a future bill. Any amendments to this, Representative Neuberger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I do have an amendment I'd like to move here to get the bill in the shape I was looking forward to. One quick note here. I see Representative Chair Garofalo has arrived. He was next in line. I will defer to him if you want to table my bill and move on to his. It's your call. I'll let you guys confer on that. I can wait to process to follow the agenda if that's what you'd like to do.
Keep talking like it's a show.
All right, I'll keep talking. apparently we're going to keep moving here. So I do have an amendment. It's the A16 amendment I'd like to move to get the bill in the shape that I'd like to be in.
And how's that amendment coded, Representative Neuberger?
That amendment is coded A16-1041.
All right. Representative Neuberger moves the A16 amendment to get the bill in the form that he would like. Is there any discussion on that amendment?
Good
Representative
question.
Hortman?
Is there a 24-hour rule in this committee?
Representative Hortman, there is.
And did this amendment meet the 24-hour rule?
There was a...
It was submitted to me.
Okay, so Representative Hortman, what I'm told by our highly competent staff is that the amendment was submitted, but that the wrong one was posted online. So if the minority objects to it in this case, I can certainly not allow Representative Neuberger to move this amendment. So if you get, but there is a 24-hour rule, so I'll leave that. This is kind of a unique situation, but it's up to you guys. If you don't want it, certainly we have a 24-hour rule, and the rule is that it would be posted within that time frame. Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the motion with regard to this bill?
It's to lay it over for possible inclusion in a later bill.
Then I have no problem with it.
All right. With that, Representative Neuberger, any other questions or comments? Representative Neuberger moves the A16-1041 amendment to get the bill in the form he would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Representative Neuberger, do you have something to add?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate your grace in this endeavor. This amendment was posted or was submitted last Thursday. The reason the wrong amendment got posted is because of the fine work. I'd want to say to our nonpartisan staff, I want to say thank you because they were babysitting me and they did a good job. Unfortunately, it was the wrong amendment, but they were looking out for me. But my compliments to nonpartisan staff because they really they did a good job on this one. They caught one here.
So, Representative Neuberger, before we proceed, now that the chair has gotten situated, is the department here for House File 3003? Is the department here? They are. Okay, so I tell you what, Representative Neuberger, we're going to put you on pause.
Yep.
We're going to table your motion. We'll bring it back up, and we're going to do House File 3003 so the department doesn't have to sit around and wait. Is that all right?
Even better.
All right, so Representative Neuberger moves that House File 2817 is amended, be laid on the table. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The bill is on the table. So if we get the department come down for House File 3003, the chair will move House File 3003 for possible inclusion in a later bill.
Yep.
All right, so... And Ms. Newman, do you want to cover this amendment for me?
Well,
Yes. So this amendment, though, is drafted to the underlying amendment, not to the...
To the bill.
Good. Okay. So, Ms. Newman, on House File 3003, I'm going to move the A1 amendment. Will you please cover that for members of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I have copies of the amendment as well.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair and members, the amendment that's being passed out is just clarifying in Article 6 of this bill, it makes changes to the Governor's Workforce Development Council. It recreates it and reconfigures it in alignment with the new Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. In doing so, it specifies who the members of that council are, and this amendment just clarifies there was a reference to the Commissioner of Adult Basic Education in the Department of Education, and that it's the Commissioner of Education. So this amendment fixes that, and then on page 7, line 1, it just clarifies that there is a representative of the women's with expertise in women's economic security instead of a reference to a representative of the act itself, which would not exist.
And the department, my understanding is that this is the amendment you guys want to put on the department's bill. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay. So, members, this is this amendment was drafted today, but it is with the intent of the department to have it this way. So is there any objection to us waiving the 24-hour rule on this amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Ms. Newman, the next amendment is the A16-1045 amendment. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And is the research summary in our packet drafted to include this amendment, or is it?
It is not.
Okay. So let's, if you could you briefly cover that? And on the front side, let me just ask the department again. My understanding is the A16-1045 amendment is consistent with what the department wishes?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay. So, Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chair, this is a department of amendment. Page 1, the Section 3 change, this is to the job creation program, and it, under current law, the grant agreements are for 5 years. This would allow those agreements to extend up to 7 years. On page 2, at the bottom of the page, line 36, this amendment would increase this new Workforce Development Council that's being set up. The underlying bill would increase the membership to 41. This bill increases it to 49. Under current law, the board or the Governor's Workforce Development Council is 31 members. So this, with the amendment, it would increase to 49 voting members. Mr. Chair, do you want me to go through these line by line, or?
I think maybe the higher points would be appropriate. It looks like there's composition of the is changing and the white
right.
are. So I don't think it's entirely necessary. As always, a brief overview
okay.
is always appreciated by members of the committee.
The changes on page 3 from line 1 through at least line 28 are conforming changes to increasing the board to 49 members. Page 3, line 29 inserts a bylaw section or subdivision, which I assume was inadvertently admitted from the original draft. Page 3, line 32, that's just a conforming numbering change. And the balance of those changes on page 3 are just conforming to the increased number of membership, number of members on the board. And Mr. Chair, page 4, lines 1 through 8 are conforming changes. Section 2 just provides for the initial meeting and the initial appointments to this Workforce Development Board.
Thank you, Ms. Newman. And again, my understanding is this is consistent with what the department wants, and this amendment, it was not posted within the 24-hour rule as well. Again, this bill is being laid over for possible inclusion, so is there any objections to us taking this amendment up? All right, so any questions on the amendment? Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question for the testifier on this amendment. Page 1, starting at line 12, where you insert the new language, the metropolitan area outside the metropolitan area may be up for 7 years in length. I have two questions. What's the metro area's length of a grant? And then why are we, if it's different, why are we making it different from the metro area?
To testify.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, the change that's in the amendment on page 1, lines 12, 13, and 14 are actually simply to conform to Department of, or to make it clear that the program as it was enacted several years ago conforms with Department of Admin statutes, in the statute 16B.98. The program as it was originally conceived and has been in practice since it was put into place provides for 5 years of loans for businesses within the metro area and 7 outside. You can see that outside the metro area in Greater Minnesota. You can see that on line 1.10 shows the underlying statute says that a qualified business can receive 5 years for project, I'm sorry, just above that, 5 years for projects located in the metropolitan area and 7 years for projects located outside. So when the program was developed a couple of years ago, that was put into place so that greater Minnesota businesses could have a little bit longer of a time period to repay those grants. Or to be eligible for those grants, excuse me. So Department of Admin has the statute 16B.98 that allows for grant years of up to 5 years. So there's a conflict between the statute for the Job Creation Fund and 16B.98. So we want to keep the program as is. We just want to appease the Department of Administration and their statute.
Representative Mahoney.
Kind of a comment more than a question. Is there much ever accomplished with a committee of 49?
I don't know. We could check in with the Ways and Means Committee. See, but
quite 49, but close.
So, point taken. I assume that question was rhetorical, Representative Mahoney. You weren't really looking for an answer from the.
I said it was more of a comment.
Okay, I appreciate that. Is there any other discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The A16-1045 amendment is adopted. I believe the bill is now in the form that the department would like. To your presentation. And did you formally state your name for the record yet or not? Why don't we have you do that so 100 years from now we know who you are?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Kim Babine. I am the Director of Policy at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Thank you for the time today to hear this bill. It's Deeds housekeeping policy bill for the year. I'll just briefly go through article by article. Article 1 to the underlying bill already spoke to the one piece of the amendment. So on page 1, there are a few changes to the job expansion program that was put into place a couple years ago. The job expansion program was launched mid-2014 and is not being used to the extent that we would hope. So we are asking that the requirements be somewhat loosened. Right now, the requirement is that a city, or that a business be operating within city limits, and we would like to have that requirement removed simply to get more activity in the program so it can be doing the work that the legislature intended for it to do. Article 2 relates to promotional authority. This has to do with the work that we do at the department with contracting as we promote Minnesota for trade and economic development purposes. For the last 10 or 15 years, the program staff of the department remember that it was the practice to have contracts or have this promotional authority contract eligibility for certain solicitations. MMB has recently begun taking a stricter reading of the underlying statute that you can see, and so we want to make it clear in the statute that we are allowed to do what was done in practice for the last 15 years or so. Article 3 was removed by the amendment, the A16-1045 amendment. Article 4 is a small change to workforce development program outcomes, the report card for workforce development programs that we have discussed in this committee. On line 4.25, you can see that the changes the median wages of participants employed during 4 consecutive quarters as opposed to 3. This changes for a couple different reasons. One, it helps people draw a more meaningful before and after picture of participants. It also mirrors the pre-enrollment wage that we collect elsewhere in this report card. And then 1 year of reporting data is easier for folks who are using the data to understand, and so and for people to work with. So we're requesting that change. Article 5 regarding pay for performance grants. There's this section of deed law that allows the program or allows for a program in which the department pays for performance. It's a different way of providing grant funds to an organization. For the most part, this is only used by Twin Cities Rise in their pay for performance model. Unfortunately, there are 3 conflicting statutes as to how this works. 116J.8747 is the pay-for-performance statute. 16A.28 is a statute that says that encumbrances are canceled October 15th for the previous fiscal year. And 16B.98 is the Office of Grants Management Reimbursement Policy. And so we are saying that because they're in conflict, we want to make sure that it's clear that you can pick one and grants can be administered in that fashion. The Workforce Development Board changes that you see, that the amendment also made a number of changes to. These changes are necessary because, as Ms. Newman mentioned, the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, the federal law that governs a lot of the federal money that comes in for the workforce system, was renewed a couple years ago, and under that law there are some changes that need to be made to all the state boards. This statute is so that Minnesota complies with the federal law. That's why you see the repealer is for the Workforce Development Council. So this, instead of, it looks like it's creating a new board, it simply is replacing the board that is in current existence, and it was just cleaner to redraft than make the changes throughout. You are right, the membership is quite high. There is a provision in the federal law that states that there has to be a majority private sector membership on the board, and so to accommodate the other members that the legislature and others have said are important members on that board, it needed to grow so that the majority could be private sector members. So it is a large board, but the bylaws section that was adopted in the amendment allows for an executive committee, and there are a number of other committees that are in operation as well, so that the work of the board is manageable. Other than that, the changes to the board itself are not substantial to the underlying what is being repealed, and that is simply the repealer of that board, just replacing it with the new language there. And that's the bill, Mr. Chair. Happy to answer any questions on specifics.
For Ms. Hendricks or from nonpartisan staff, does this bill have any fiscal impact at all?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the department could probably speak to that. As I understand it, the board would be funded by the federal funds that come in through the program, and the Senate has a fiscal note on the original language of the bill, so not with including the amendments that have been adopted here, and some amendments have been adopted on the Senate side, and the department came back with a zero cost on the bill.
Is that correct? There's no fiscal. So this bill, as amended, is it expected that there's a fiscal cost?
Mr. Chair, members, no. No fiscal cost.
So how does the expansion of the board not have a cost, though?
The Mr. Chair, members, the expansion of the board still, we provide, the department provides administrative costs through those federal funds that Ms. Hendricks mentioned, and so the reporting that's done, the research and other activities that's done to support the board doesn't change substantially with the addition of members.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, when you add 10 people, you're going to get more costs. I'm not sure exactly how it's being hidden, but that's another story. Ms. Babine, do you have a record of the attendance of the full board? I mean, I'm just wondering, you got 39 or 37 now, and you're going to 49 or 41, whatever it may be. Do you take attendance at these board meetings? Or does someone take attendance? Not you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I don't have that with me. I can get that for you. I have not checked the attendance myself, and so, but I assume they take, it's captured in the minutes, so I can get that for you.
Ms. Babine, I'd actually like to, you can go back 12 months or 18 months or whatever, I'd like to understand, because the Governor's Workforce Council has been a large organization, and I've seen all the reports. I just once you start getting a committee this large, I just can't imagine what innovation comes out of it, because you're trying to keep everybody, you're trying to keep at least 26 people happy to vote for it, or what's half of 49, 24, 25 people happy. So all of a sudden you're starting to water it down and water it down. The innovation is hard to get to. And with the workforce shortage we're going to see in the next 5, 10, and 20 years, we need substantial innovation coming from this particular board and from this committee. But I'll pick on the chair. I'm not seeing that this year. But, when you have almost a zero target, it's hard to do innovation. So I'll just leave it at that, and that's one of the reasons why I'd like to get that number.
Representative Mahoney, we have a huge target. We get to spend over $11 million more. That's a colossal expansion in government spending. It's the largest target in the House of Representatives. It's a huge target. Is there any other questions or comments for the
well, I've got a comment.
Representative Mahoney?
Whatever.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of this bill and move to member questions and comments. Any closing words from the department?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the time.
Thank you. And with that, the chair renews his motion to have House File 3003 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you very much. As amended. Sorry. All right, Representative Neuberger, you're back up. So the chair will move that we remove House File 2817 from the table. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Representative Neuberger, two-year bill. First of all, do you have any invited testifiers you wish to have?
I do, Mr. Chair. I can bring them down as needed here. I'll call down the two testifiers that I've brought from the city of Becker, Mayor Kleiss and Council Member Rick Hendrickson. And I also have a third testifier from the Coalition of Utility Cities. She will be coming down a little bit later.
And Representative Neuberger, so this is how, and tell me if this is okay with you. What I'm thinking is I'm going to get, the committee will give you 20 minutes for the proponents to offer their test, up to 20 minutes total for proponents to offer their testimony and your comments. And then we'll give opponents of the bill an equal amount of time, up to an equal amount of time. And then we'll go to comments and member questions. Is that all right, Representative Neuberger?
That works for me, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hartman.
Can Representative Neuberger, can you just explain really briefly what's the difference between the bill that we prepared for today and the amendment that we found out about this morning?
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you for your question, Representative Hartman. Basically, what the change is, the amendment that we drafted, is a percentage change. That's one of the biggest changes in there. Initially, my The amendment, the DE amendment that was posted had 10% allocation for affected cities, communities, and an additional 2% for workers, disaffected workers. What my amendment basically did is it shrunk it down to a straight 10%, 9% would go to the cities, and 1% would go to those disaffected, displaced workers as well. Also, the other big significant change that I have here, there are two. One is that the A19 amendment, which we are now using, pushes the start date back 1 year, so anything that ceases after 2009. And then the final major change in, was I put a sunset provision in. That wasn't in the original. I don't like open-ended, I don't want to call us appropriations. It's an allocation. I don't like open-ended allocations, and so I put a sunset provision in there. So I made it, I cleaned it up, is what I did.
Representative Hartman, any follow-up?
I can follow up when we get to member questions, if you'd prefer.
Sounds good. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 2817 is a bipartisan bill that has a broad range of support here. Very briefly, recently the EPA mandated, as we know, that all states reduce their carbon dioxide emissions. Minnesota was in the top 10. We have been ordered to reduce our carbon emissions by 42%. Each state has to create its own plan, as we've heard about in the past, to do so. If you don't do it, then the federal government will force you to comply with the plan that they will create by the EPA. Each state will also need to create what's called a cap-and-trade system in order to make these plans work. This cap-and-trade system is a carbon credit system. In order for this cap-and-trade system to function, you must shut down coal power plants. That's the bottom line. You got to shut them down. Because that's going to be one of the things that makes this whole thing work. Thus, closing a coal plant could create a supply of carbon credits, and keeping one open could create a demand for carbon credits. The government or the EPA will be the entity that creates and distributes these credits to each utility in Minnesota, so that when these occur, these credits, I like to think of them as like a stock certificate, would go. They'd be divided up amongst the utilities. The EPA will also set forth the standard in conjunction with the MPCA of how much CO2 that you as a utility will be able to produce every year. So if you are the Garofalo Power Company at the beginning of the year, you'll be given a percentage of how much CO2 you'll be able to produce. And you'll have to either get underneath that, or if you go over it, you're going to have to spend credits or purchase credits from other companies that have gone underneath. My bill, 2817, will have, I want to be very clear on something. My bill, 2817, will have no effect, none, whether or not a cap-and-trade system will exist. Whether or not this bill becomes law won't make any difference as whether or not a cap-and-trade system will exist. This system is in place. It's being pushed for. I've got the report here from the Department of Commerce and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency back to the EPA. And it's very glowing. They embrace a cap-and-trade system. In fact, their own words are they applaud the use of a flexible trading system. So it will exist whether or not my bill comes to fruition. For the record, I oppose cap-and-trade. I don't like it. One more time, I oppose cap-and-trade. But this is going to be a system that, if things play out the way that they intend them to, will be forced upon us regardless. Any utility that produces less CO2, they'll have excess credits. They can sell or trade them amongst the other utilities. The MPCA and the Department of Commerce is currently working on a plan for Minnesota. We don't know if it'll be a mass-based or a rate-based plan. Most folks will assume, and as myself, it'll probably be mass-based, but we don't know yet. What does that mean for us? In my opinion, there's a race to shut down coal plants. That's my opinion, and I think it's well-founded. This will have a dramatic effect on the communities that have coal-based power plants. In all of the paperwork that I've gotten from the LEC and then I've read from the MPCA and the Department of Commerce, I've seen a fair amount of reports and paperwork on how these plans are unfolding, the stakeholder meetings and all of this, but I've yet to ever see any anything that addresses how they're going to help these communities that are affected. So how many coal-driven economies do we have in Minnesota? We have East Grand Forks, Crookston, Moorhead, Renville, Mankato, Wilmer, Virginia, Hibbing, Cohasset. We have Bayport. All of these encompass, some of them, hundreds of jobs. Some plants that have already been affected, New Elm was stopped. Hoot Lake in Fergus Falls, that's the first domino to fall. And for your information, it's going to cost about 40 full-time jobs. It's going to eliminate 40% of their tax base and also a short-line railroad. The Saliskin plant, Laskin plant, that's up in Hoot Lake, or White Lake, it was converted to natural gas, but they lost 30 jobs plus 13 support jobs, according to the Mesaba Daily News. Black Dog was closed down or was converted, as we know, in Burnsville. Taconite Harbor was retired early. 45 jobs were lost there. Plus, Taconite Harbor had to pay $1.4 million in legal fees. Expansion of new plants. New Elm was stopped. Taconite, Minnesota was stopped. Rosemont was stopped. And currently in Becker, where you all know that I reside, we're looking at a 66% reduction in power, which will cost us about 150 jobs. Alone. Even if we replace it with a gas plant, that won't replace more than 10% of what we're going to lose. As we know, the standard formula is there are four service jobs roughly for every production and manufacturing job. So this is far-reaching. We're going to lose tax revenues, public services, police, fire, EMS. I want to be real clear here too. I spoke with all of the utilities today, the representatives. They don't generally support any type of set-aside for any carbon credit to any group. That was their position that they communicated to me. Right now, this is being done in other states. In Kentucky, passed a bill through their committee. A Democrat chair, a good friend of mine, John Short, passed the bill. I got copies of it here. This one goes a little farther. What this one does is it takes an additional 50% of the carbon credits, sells them back, and then refunds the money to the ratepayers. So I don't think my bill really is as far-reaching as some might think it might be. This is going to have a dramatic effect. It's going to be devastating to these communities. And what I'm asking we do here, members, is that we take a hard look at the future that we're about to lay out for these communities. What my bill will do is it will divide up these, takes 10% of the carbon credits right off the top. 1% will go to disaffected workers to help out with relocation, retraining, and retirement funds. And the other 9% will be divided up equally according to a formula about how much carbon you produce. And those credits will be distributed amongst the communities that are being affected by early retirements and shutdowns of their coal plants. That money will go to help with economic development to get them back on their feet. And again, there's a sunset on this. It's 20 years, which we can work with as well. I don't want anything going into perpetuity. With that, I have a couple of testifiers here. I have Rick Hendrickson from the Becker City Council, and I also have Mayor Lefty Kleiss from Becker City. This is also supported by Sherman County. There's a letter of support here if the page wants to send this out. And then also you have a copy in your files. I have a copy from the Hoyt Lakes, Minnesota. The mayor also support this as well. There are other communities that have joined us in this endeavor. With that, I will defer to my testifiers. Rick?
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jerome Kleiss. I'd like to thank the House Jobs Energy Committee, along with Representative Jim Neuberger, for the opportunity to share with the committee our story. Becker is a small community of about 4,500 people. We're located in Sherburne County. Becker is the host community to the Sherburne County Generating Station, also known as the Sherco plant. The Sherco plant has a capacity to produce 2,400 megawatts of power, which is enough to provide about 2 million homes with electricity. Sherco is the primary economic driver for the city of Becker. This power plant provides about 350 jobs for local residents and approximately another 800 jobs during peak maintenance projects. The plant also provides local tax revenue and supports local police and fire services. The plant also supports the local schools, which includes about 3,000 students. Steam from the Sherco plant is also used by a local paper recycling mill, Liberty Paper. Liberty Paper is also a major employer in Becker, providing about 140 high-paying jobs. Loss of energy jobs will directly and significantly impact the city, schools, and local employers like Liberty Paper. In addition to the local economy, power generation in Becker also supports regional jobs in the transportation, steel, machining, pipe fitting, retail, and service industries. In fact, for every one worker at the Sherco plant, there are about four service jobs within the region that support the facility, creating an economic ripple effect throughout the region. I'd like to close with this. As the committee debates the affected communities' legislation, please take into consideration that Becker and the region will need assistance in transitioning from a coal-based economy. These carbon credits will go a long way to help with that transition. Again, I'd like to thank the House Jobs and Energy Committee and Representative Neuberger for the opportunity to tell our story.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Rick Hendrickson, and I serve with Mayor Kleiss on the Becker City Council. I also serve our residents on our Economic Development Authority, and that's economic development is what I'd like to focus on today. First, I'd like to address one of the points made by the environmentalists and others in regards to the Sherco workforce. You may have heard that much of the job loss associated with an early Sherco closing will be absorbed through attrition at retirement. Although partially true, this does not paint the whole picture, and I'd like to elaborate on that a little bit. Around 50% of the Sherco workforce is eligible to retire in the next 10 years, and this in itself is a true statement. With the early closing of Units 1 and 2, we should see most, if not all, these eligible employees retire. This prevents the dramatic scene of hundreds of people walking out of Sherco on a Friday with their toolbox in one hand and a pink slip in the other. But what does the job picture look like today before any units are shut down? Most of the jobs at Sherco are union, meaning they're at least partially based off seniority. Most of the people nearing retirement would be at the top, and as they retire, their jobs would be filled by employees in the middle, which allows employees at the bottom to move up. And eventually, this leads to the hiring of entry-level workers, and the cycle continues. As folks are either hired or promoted, this often leads to home purchases, some for the first time, others upsizing. The missing piece in the statement about attrition is that all of this movement in the home market no longer happens when we simply lose people to retirement. There's a lot more that can be said about the direct effects this will have on the community, and Mayor Kleiss touched on a few of them. I'm going to stick with housing for now because it ties in with economic development. We recently completed our Highway 10 corridor study, which dealt primarily with commercial properties, which would be on the north side of Highway 10. We had third-party research performed as well as focus groups with area builders, brokers, and realtors, and they all said the same thing. The number one thing to drive commercial development along Highway 10 is rooftops. Now you can see the tie in here. The reduction of workers, whether through mass retirement or layoff, will affect the real estate market, which will in turn affect the commercial market. Although some refer to the statement about losing jobs through attrition in a positive light, we would look at it as a negative. The committee, you've all been to Becker last fall, but for those maybe not familiar with our town, we have our residential and commercial to the north of Highway 10 and our industrial, including Sherco, to the south. I'd like to jump to the south and talk about what this bill before you could do for us. The city of Becker is proactive in our efforts to bring new industrial residents to town. There's no doubt the potential early retirements of Units 1 and 2 are making that task tougher, but that's not going to deter us. Although there are many factors beyond our control, there are also many things we can do. We are not going to simply throw in the towel and play victim. By starting now and not waiting until the last minute, we hope to soften the blow and make the successful transition instead of becoming another statistic, and this is where this bill can help. Most of our existing industrial park is full, meaning that any new development would most likely occur on existing land the city owns or through purchasing from local landowners. These new plots will need city services run to them, and as the committee knows, infrastructure is expensive, especially when you consider the length of the extension. It would be disappointing to go through all the trouble of landing an industrial resident only to lose them because we cannot afford to run services. One of the main uses of these funds would be to assist the city in providing infrastructure to fuel future industrial and commercial expansion, as well as to stabilize the tax base for our existing residents so we don't lose them. In closing, the Clean Power Plan creates a system of winners and losers. Unfortunately, Becker and the other cities that host coal-fired power plants would become one of the losers. The majority of the constituents we speak to do not support the Clean Power Plan or the idea of carbon credits. but we also understand how things really work. If the Clean Power Plan is upheld and the idea of carbon credits is thrust upon us, Becker and the other cities that host coal-fired power plants stand to lose big. We are here to ask that we be considered in the equation when it comes to the distribution of those credits. At the end of the day, we all became involved in politics to make a difference, and you have before you a bill that would have a positive influence on the city of Becker and other cities that play host to coal-fired power plants. With that, I can take any questions if there are any.
Well, we're going to take public testimony first, and then we'll come back to individual questions. Thank you very much. Representative Neuberger, do you have any other invited testifiers?
We do. We have one more, Carolyn Jackson from the Coalition Utility Cities.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Carolyn Jackson, and I'm an attorney lobbyist of the firm Flaherty & Hood, and I'm here on behalf of the Coalition of Utility Cities. I draw your attention to the letter from Hoyt Lakes. They are a community that have seen a change from oil to, or from coal to natural gas, and they're sort of the precursor of what's going to be happening in communities around the state as this happens. We as host utility cities just want to draw attention to the legislature that this change will make a big impact on our communities, and we would like to have a voice at the table, and we are looking forward to working with all the stakeholders in adjusting to the changes that will happen under the Clean Power Plan. And that's my statement.
Thank you very much. Representative Neuberger, any other testifiers you should wait?
I have none.
All right, thank you. At this point, we'll open it up for those who are opposed to this. I think what we'll do is Representative Neuberger went about 18 minutes. I think we'll give up to 25 minutes for opponents of it to go to the 2:30 time frame. The committee will go late today, members. And so if you are someone who has concerns with the bill, we'll move to that. Currently on the list, I have, we'll start with, I shouldn't state I know your position on this, but is Mr. Thornton here? So I don't want to state that you're opposed to the bill because I don't know that, but I suspect you may have concerns with the bill. So we'll go with you, and then Ms. Hamilton will be next from Fresh Energy. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Pollution Control Agency. The PCA has just recently concluded a series of meetings around the state, listening sessions really, where we've been seeking input on the Clean Power Plan. And we've heard from several hundred Minnesotans regarding potential issues that might arise from implementation of this regulation. There have been a number of concerns expressed. One of them has been the concern that Representative Neuberger is here to address. And I would like to commend him for all the hard work he's been putting into this issue. But we've also heard from energy intensive trade exposed industries and their concerns about it. We've heard from ratepayers in general. We've heard people that want to use this to as an incentive for more renewables. We've heard people talk about using allowances as an incentive for additional energy efficiency. We've heard people talk about offsetting costs for low income communities. And some people have suggested that we should auction the allowances and raise a bunch of money to do something with. And all of these are good ideas. We just think it's premature to move ahead with one of them. We'd like to sort through some of this stuff more holistically and see what the best package of things might be for Minnesota. So our preference would be that you not move forward with this right now.
Well, thank you, Mr. Thornton. The next testifier I have on this list is Jay Drake Hamilton. Oh, go ahead. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and continue.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jay Drake Hamilton. I serve as a science policy director at Fresh Energy. We're an independent energy nonprofit based here in Minnesota, and I also want to thank Representative Neuberger for his work, and saw him in action at several of the listening sessions as well, so thank you so much. Fresh Energy, like all the stakeholders in the Clean Power Plan implementation in Minnesota, there are many of them, I think over 150 at some meetings, are interested in how Minnesota can best meet our obligation at the lowest cost to customers. And we think that this bill as written is premature because there are a number of questions that have not yet been answered in terms of this particular set of issues that have been raised. One is that what would the credit value be for these allowances? The current Clean Power Plan has no trading market for allowances, and so in terms of earning credits, how would a community receive compensation who would they be selling credits to if there's no market? We know that Minnesota is not the only state that's working on implementation. Our neighbor states and every other state is considering implementation, and whether that will include trading or not include trading will determine the size of the market and who's in the market, so what the quality of the market is like. So very literally, how much money these credits would be worth and what would go to communities, and I think that's really important. What is the monetary value of each allowance? And so we won't really know that until we know what each state's plan is and which state opts for the federal plan instead. And what that would mean, what is the size and value of the allowance pool that would be available to any community? We also think it's, in general, not good policy to allocate credits prematurely until you're looking with all the stakeholders and people are at the same table and able to evaluate the analyses of what that those allocations mean going forward. We think the stakeholder table is a great place for continued input from all stakeholders. Routinely every month we hear analyses from a wide variety of perspectives, and it would be great to have these included in that. And thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we will close the public comment section and move to member questions. Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Neuberger, so in your amendment today, why did you decrease the amount of money set aside to go for workers?
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hortman. That's a really good question. We did that partially in conjunction with what Ms. Hamilton was talking about. We weren't exactly sure exactly how much each credit would be worth, 1% or 2%. We weren't, like I said, we couldn't put a number on that. And I think that the easiest way to really start this discussion and to carry it through is not to keep adding on to it, but just to work within the original 10%. I think that that's a workable number, and if we want to increase it to 2% and then decrease the city's affected communities to 8%, I mean, that's a discussion we can have. But at this time, what I wanted to do was just stay within the parameters of the original bill.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the central focus should be on the workers, and when we look at economic distress in the state, whether it's avian flu or what's happening on the range, I think that we have to look at what's happening to the whole community, but keep the focus on the workers. So I'm just a little concerned with only 1% directed towards the workers and 9% towards the community, though I don't doubt the community will have significant impact. For a family, a job is everything. So,
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Neuberger.
A quick follow-up to that. I agree with you, but I want to be clear that the city of Becker is not going to be getting 9%. If we stretch this out across the state with all the different coal-driven economies that we have, the city of Becker might get less than 1%. They might get 1%. I don't know, but I just want to be clear that it's not 1% for the disaffected workers and 9% for Becker. That's never going to happen. Becker's only going to get a small portion of that. Cohasset, up on the range, they would get some. All of the communities that have had coal plants that have been shut down early because of all of the EPA mandates.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Neuberger, does this prohibit these towns then from getting other state-funded economic development funds? I mean, that would seem fair, because you're doing something, you're basically moving them ahead and giving them another revenue stream that St. Paul or Rochester or Wilmer may not have.
Representative Neuberger.
I can see where you're going with this, Representative Mahoney, but I'd have to disagree with you, because Wilmer is one of the affected communities.
Okay.
But St. Paul or Minneapolis, they are not facing, well, St. Paul would be part of one too because of Black Dog. However, not Black Dog, Burnsville, Highbridge. Minneapolis didn't lose a coal plant. These are communities that had, for a word picture, had a rug pulled out from under their feet first. And also, just for the record, the city of Becker doesn't get LGA. Most of these cities, if they do, they get very little because of the power plants that are in them. They already get little or reduced state aid as it is. If you want to carry this forward into other areas of state aid, that's a discussion that we can certainly have. But at this point in the game, this doesn't affect that, no.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
My question had nothing to do with LGA. I was talking more about other economic development funds that this state provides to cities, counties, towns, you know, job creation fund or whatever. So I think your argument is went off in a different way. Second, I have a couple of you.
Sure.
You can answer any question I ask any way you particularly like, but I'll just come back to it.
Noted.
The other question I have here is, have you thought through the process, workers getting what essentially is a severance package or job training aids, have you talked to the unemployment people? Because typically that affects their unemployment. And they cannot collect unemployment until they've run through all of their all the benefits that come from the industry an industry fund, so such as a severance package or vacation time or some of the other things. Have you talked to them at all, and have you got a plan for that? What this 1% might do?
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mahoney. We aren't forcing anyone to take any money. If you are a disaffected worker and you've been working at the Garofalo coal plant for 15 years and now all of a sudden you have no job, that money will be there. You don't have to take it. It's not going to be forced on you. If there are other streams of revenue or aid that you are getting, I would think that as an employee that had just been laid off, that you would probably choose what was best for your family. And some of these questions, and I'm glad you're asking these, some of these questions we are definitely going to have to iron out and really explore. I am not going to sit here and pretend that I've got an all-inclusive, exhaustive bill that's going to cover every jot and tittle that could come up. What I'm trying to do, Representative Mahoney, is lay a foundation to make sure that these communities and these workers don't get thrown under the bus.
Representative Mahoney?
And I'll have I have one other question, and just so that you understand, it doesn't matter whether that employee chooses to take those funds or not. They have to take those funds and use them before they can get unemployment. And the same, the third question, and then I'll be done, because I don't think your bill is ready for prime time, is you still have to look at, are these employees going to be able to double dip with this 1% job training money and workforce trainings money, because that would be a double dip. And I've heard comments around this table about double dipping and how that's, we don't approve of that. So
Representative
my
Neuberger.
Question, maybe you haven't thought to that piece yet, but you're going to have to. If you have, can you answer that?
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Mahoney, the way I see it is that this would really help other workers in other communities or in other industries who are laid off. If these funds can come alongside, if we can use some of this money to help supplement those funds, then that would open up even more funds for other workers in other industries who have lost their jobs. This could be a source of revenue that would really be a blessing overall. And again, I appreciate your comments, and I'm not going to make, you know, I'm not going to try to iron out every wrinkle. But this is simply what we're trying to do, is lay a foundation, and if we're able to do this, because regardless, this is going to, if we follow through with this power plan like the state is currently doing, then part of that equation is going to be cap and trade, and I don't like cap and trade, but that is the hand that we've been dealt. And if we've been dealt that hand, then let's at least take one card out of that hand and lay it down on the communities and the workers that are being affected by this. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to lay a foundation to help these communities and the people that are affected by a policy-driven change.
Representative Mahoney, and just I want to make sure, did we complete public testimony when I stepped out?
Yes.
Okay, so we're done with public testimony. Representative Mahoney.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is not a question. You may be trying to lay down a foundation, but what you're really doing is saying that they go to the front of the line because they had a economic hardship. We have other towns, other cities, other communities that suffer economic hardship, and they do not get to go to the front of the line. And that what you're doing here is setting a precedent that if there could be a possible problem and there might be a pot of money, that community gets to go to the front of the line, no matter what the state's needs are, no matter what the economic development needs of the state or any other community are. I would maybe see that this money goes into the economic development pot, but to actually say that Fernsville or Wilmer or Hoyt Lakes or whomever gets to have a special pot that only they get to use, you know, kind of handcuffs people. And then to not put any restrictions on it as to, well, you get this pot so you don't get the other one. We've done that with workforce training. Your bill has a long way to go.
Okay, so just to, before we go on member questions, Representative Scott, you're next on the list. Just so members of the committee understand this, what this is that because of the actions of the federal government, even though the Supreme Court decision has been stayed, if this were to go forward, and this is government creating an instrument of value. That's what a carbon allowance is. It's creating an instrument of value. Think of it as pallets of money sitting out on the dock of a state office building. And the question is, where are those pallets of money going to go? Who gets to decide where those pallets of money go? Who's allowed to compete for them? Who's allowed to take them? Does it require legislative action? Does the executive branch do this? These are all, so we could have a month-long conversation about this, but think of it today. When you're having conversations about the allowances, these are pallets of money that are, if the government has its way, are going to go places. And so this is a smaller microcosm of a much larger issue. The decision is stayed today, so obviously it's going to be stayed for a while. We'll see what the next presidential election does. That's pretty much going to decide what happens with this stuff going forward. But think of it as pallets of money. That's what this is. So, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question for Mr. Thornton and Ms. Hamilton.
Ms. Hamilton, Mr. Thornton, you still here? Come on down. Representative Scott, to your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm glad you made that point that one of the big differences here with other dislocated workers and so forth is that those are usually just they're casualties of bad economic times. This is actually the government basically acting and making these jobs go away. To both of the testifiers, and you can go in whichever order you'd like, you both mentioned that you thought that Representative Neuberger's bill was premature, and so I'm just wondering what your solution is for helping these dislocated workers in their communities.
To either of the testifiers?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, we haven't come up with one yet because we're still seeking input from people. This is one way that could try to address that concern. There may be others, and we'd like to take some time and think about it and get more input and maybe put together a package that addresses a number of the kinds of concerns that we've heard, not just the one about affected cities and workers.
Ms. Hamilton?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would agree with that. Because there is no state plan at this point, and furthermore, there adjacent states and other states in the union do not have plans as well, we don't really know if there will be a market. We don't know if there will be any trading allowed, and we don't know who the trading partners are. So now is a good time to take the time and figure out how to resolve those worker issues in a way where the analysis actually shows that you're getting what you intend to do to help those workers out.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But you would both agree that something needs to be done to help these workers out, or
well, I would, that they represent. Mr. Chairman, I would agree that it's one of the big concerns that we've heard when we were out listening around the state. So it's something that we're going to be thinking about.
Representative Scott.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to the bill as I read it, I just want to make sure I understand it correctly. The subdivision 4, 2.14, where it talks about this section, this the allocation of mission credits that you've laid out, they only apply if the PUC determines they've met the requirements 1 through 4, I think, on the first page under paragraph B. Is that my understanding? So does that mean then if they determine that the Clean Power Act wasn't a significant factor, then it wouldn't apply the plan that you have out? Did I understand that correctly?
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yep, that is the wording in the bill, correct.
Representative Johnson.
And I'm not clear on item 2, the remaining useful life of the electric generating plant. How would the PUC use that as a determining factor? I don't quite get it.
I think it would be the Integrated Resource Plan. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Exactly. If the plant was shut down early, if it had potential economic life left in it, they would definitely take that into consideration. Because they're closing it down early, how much life did this thing have, and how much economic impact would it have had if it had stayed open?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So they'd look at that and then determine at what point it becomes a significant factor. Is that what you're?
Representative Neuberger.
That would be the case. They'd go case by case, and they would use that as part of their determination process.
And Mr. Chair, have you sat down with the PUC and gone over with them, maybe kind of discussing what a possible way to put this criteria together is or would be?
Representative Neuberger.
That would be my next step.
Okay.
Mr. Thornton, can you come on back down? I got a couple of questions. When you come on. Representative Johnson, do you have any other questions?
No, just a follow-up that in working with the PUC, I found it helpful to, you're coming up with the criteria to work with them on it.
Thank you. Mr. Thornton, so a question. Earlier I used the pallets of money analogy to describe the allowances. Previously we've had conversations about the department's view and the executive branch's view of the legislative branch. In determining the allocation of these carbon allowances, does the PCA believe that the legislature, that you need legislative approval to allocate those allowances?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that we do not need legislative approval to allocate the allowances. Mm-hmm. There are some approaches that we could take that probably would require legislative approval. For example, if we were to recommend an auction where the allowances would all be sold, I think we would need legislative approval there, because then there'd be money that would need to be appropriated in some way.
Would the allocation of allowances to anyone besides the power company require statutory approval?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think so, but it's possible.
So would it require, in your opinion, does it require statutory approval to take these allowances and give them to a nonprofit or an environmental advocacy organization?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think it does.
Okay. Ms. Hamilton, can you come on down? Ms. Hamilton, we've heard from the commissioner of the, we've heard from the deputy commissioner that he does not believe, the executive branch does not believe they need statutory authorization to take these allowance, I use the term pallets of money, this instrument of value, and allocate it to nonprofits. I guess I'd like your comments on that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't have any particular comments on that. I'm not an attorney. Yes, I think this is a reason why we need more deliberation on allowance allocations, if there are particular parties coming to the table as there are now, to make sure that we understand, the state understands what that value is of those allowance allocations.
So, but it's, Ms. Hamilton, it's not beyond the realm of possibility that the executive branch could determine to allocate these allowances to nonprofits, including yours, without any statutory authorization or any input from the legislature.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can only speak for my organization. We are not asking for any allowances, for sure.
Thank you for answering. So, Representative O'Neill, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Newberg. I have the district right across from you, as you know, and when we were up in the Sherco plant, and I looked over and I said, yeah, I'm just on the other side of the river. So I appreciate this, and, you know, I have workers as well in the community that's adjacent to yours that would be quite a bit affected by the Sherco change. In line of that, also, I had an interesting weekend, Representative Neuberger, and on Friday I was asked to come and attend the Wright County Township Officers meeting. And you may have heard about that because there was so much anger in the room that I was really taken back. Even though it wasn't my meeting, I ended up facilitating the meeting because all they wanted to talk about was solar. And this ties into the Clean Power Plan and sort of the ramifications beyond just the Sherco Power Plant. And it was so intense, their concerns, and even the picture. So Wright County, of course, is ground zero, really, for rolling out the Aurora Solar Project, and they have begun construction in Buffalo Township, which is in my district. And I was really taken back at what had been done to the land. Now, you know that farmland is incredibly important in my district. Mm-hmm. You have okay farmland, but we have really good farmland.
Obviously not running for the Senate.
it's a different district. But in any case, we have nice dark soil, and the further north you get, it gets more sandy, according to the farmers. But what has happened is this 80 acres in Buffalo Township, which has prime farmland, and it was unfortunately owned by somebody that was not a Wright County resident, which also rubs the local people raw. But 11 acres of mature, beautiful hardwoods, so there were oaks and maples and ash and beautiful. This piece of property was just gorgeous, and it had both trees that lined the borders, plus it had a back acreage of about 8.5 or so acres of solid woods. And you know what happened when the solar company came in? They clear cut it, but not in a way where you can actually harvest the trees. They were mangled. I have pictures of stumps that are about 3.5-4 feet high with mangled tops. There was probably a 150-year-old beautiful oak tree that had been just leveled and knocked down. And it was tree trimmers that came in, which have a different philosophy than a logger that would actually preserve, you know, the wood taken down. These folks were so angry that, one, they weren't getting communicated with because they said the name had changed 3 times. So it was, you know, Geronimo, which is a Minnesota company. We had some level of comfort with them. Enel, who now has it. And then in between, I don't even know who they were concerned with. But they said they didn't have any local control. They couldn't say yes or no because it was a PUC decision, as you know, because the Aurora Solar Project was 100 acres or 100 megawatts. So they had no local control. They were worried about their roads getting messed up with people coming in and going in and out and everything else with carrying in, you know, tonnage and tonnage and tonnage to make berms and cut down the trees and then put all the infrastructure in. And they weren't even consulted as to which roads they should be using so they don't destroy the local roads. So, I mean, their anger was just huge. And it was so bad that I actually called an emergency meeting with the new owner, which is Enel. Now, Enel was on the PUC filings to begin with, but they've since taken front and center. But, you know, in the meeting they were saying, well, I think they're a Greek company. I think they're, you know, they're naming all these different European countries. I think they're Israeli, maybe. Well, they're an Italian company. Yes. And then there was so much anger saying, why don't we have some company from Minnesota doing this? Because even their U.S. headquarters is in Massachusetts. So we had an emergency meeting. And it was the day that it was snow squalls. What a day. So we were out there in the middle of 80 acres, and we had about 5 pickup trucks full of people with club cabs, and we went across the field to the back because it was so cold. And look at this mangled mess of trees that they had knocked down. And I got to tell you, there was one farmer there that had been farming for 52 years, and he, you know, there were about a dozen of us standing there looking at this mangled mess. And they were just beside themselves. They couldn't believe this. And you look down, there's deer tracks. There had been wildlife in there. And not to mention the neighbors right next door who had just bought their dream property 5 months before it was announced that this project was going to go in. Now they're going to have to look at these rolling hills full of solar panels. There's a lot of upset people because they didn't have control. They weren't allowed to say yes or no. It just was just happening to them. So we had a long meeting, hours and hours, and not a whole lot was resolved because there isn't a whole lot to resolve. So I'm wondering, in all of this, and you're talking about compensation, and I appreciate the fact that you're looking out for people in my district as well, because I'm right across the river from you, but is there anything in your bill that gets to this bigger problem of, is there any local control in there? Are my township officers, are they going to get any remedy for a lot of the issues that they've dealt with? I'm just wondering if this bill gets to any of that.
Representative Neuberger?
There is no direct provision in the bill that would address a local control component. I do know Representative Swadzinski has a bill that had addressed that. I had one as well last session. Unfortunately, they did not come to fruition. I'd be more than happy to work with you on something this session.
Representative Neuberger, what I'm going to do, we have lots of member questions, and I'm sensing that it's important that the committee pick up more on this. We're going to continue this hearing on Wednesday. And I would invite proponents and opponents to come back with additional testifiers, because we're going to continue this conversation. But I would just a couple of thoughts from the chair just for people. Is number one, I think it's been stated today that people are under the impression that the only reason coal plants are closing is because of government action. The reality is that many of these plants are reaching the end of their life cycle, and so there's a time, utilities that they have long-term planning for when they're going to upgrade or replace these plants, and many of these assets are reaching that time. The question before us is the early decommissioning of these assets and the problems related to that. And second of all is that obviously the shale gas revolution is kicking every other energy source's tail in, and this is coal is one of the sources that are feeling the consequences of it. But I really hope members of the committee are paying attention that we're hearing from the executive branch that these pallets of money can be allocated as they see fit without legislative authorization. And this is the problem with rulemaking versus statute. And while, half the chamber may think it's okay and half the chamber may be opposed, when you have a new chief executive, you then give the authority to allocate those pallets of money to other people if you believe they have that authority. And that's just not a good idea. That's concerning. And it's especially concerning when you're entering the final 2 years of a second-term governor's administration and there's a known expectation that there's going to be staff turnover in 2 years. That should give people pause. It's not a criticism of Mr. Thornton or any individuals, but we have a system of checks and balances in this state for a reason, and you're talking about an extraordinary amount of influence and allocation of resources with zero legislative approval. And if this legislature doesn't take action on it, whatever you think about Representative Neuberger's bill, at least the legislature's chiming in and taking action on it. But if the legislature's silent on this, we are simply allowing one person to decide where potentially huge amounts of resources could be given to. So, schedule for the week. So I think I've shared this with the DFL leads and I believe members of the committee, but our deadline for passing our bill has been pushed back to next Tuesday from this Friday, so we have a couple extra days. Tentatively, what I'm hoping to do is to get the omnibus bill released and shared with the public late on Friday at the close of business day or early evening on Friday. This would allow members the opportunity to review it, contact me with any questions. Then we'll have an amendment deadline on Monday of 9 a.m. To submit amendments. The intent would be to take public testimony throughout Monday. If it's need be, we'll take additional public testimony on Tuesday with markup and passage of the bill on Tuesday. Again, this is very tentative. We'll post a formal schedule as we get later on in the week. And if members have any questions, they feel free to contact me directly. So I think I covered the schedule. So tomorrow's meeting is canceled. We're not meeting tomorrow. I also will go to member questions. Representative Clark and then Representative Gunther, did you have a question too? Or
I do have one.
Okay, we'll go to Representative Clark and Representative Gunther.
Okay, real quick. So there will be some more hearings on Wednesday we meet again. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And are we going to be hearing more bills or are we only going to be hearing this bill?
I would expect we'll hear other bills besides Representative Neuberger's.
Okay.
Yeah. Representative Gunther.
This question is about Representative Neuberger's bill. Is that
what you want? Well, I think we're going to continue the hearing in the future, but okay. So any other questions? Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, so then you're expecting that staff will be drafting amendments over the weekend between 5 p.m. or later on Friday and 9 a.m. Monday morning?
Yeah, again, my goal is I want to actually get the bill out earlier than 5 p.m. on Friday. But I don't want to tell people we're going to have this done Friday morning or Thursday night, because then if you know something happens, we've gone past deadline. That would be the far end of the deadline. And, of course, the earlier we get the bill out before 5 p.m., the more likely it is that we're going to hold that out. The chair will hold strong on the 9 a.m. deadline for amendments. The closer we get to 5 p.m., or if we end up going beyond 5 p.m. on Friday, then the chair is more inclined to accept amendments beyond 9 a.m. Right now, those are just deadlines. Again, my experience with this has been that if the chair tries to limit people to a specific window to draft amendments, it results in a longer markup and amendment process. So I'm not going to do that. If you have any questions, you can talk with me offline, but I would expect the 5 p.m. deadline is the absolute latest goal. I'm looking to get the bill out substantially earlier than that. So Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, in the interest of the staff who would be working on amendments for us, I would hope that you could get the bill out by Thursday so that people would have at least one business day where the whole reviser staff and House Research is actually supposed to be here, scheduled to be here to work with members.
Yep, and Representative Hortman, I agree with that goal. And again, it's on my part to get this bill out earlier rather than later, because the earlier we get it done, the more that happens. And it's not just revisers and partisan staff, it's nonpartisan staff. So there's lots of people who would really appreciate it if I got the bill out early. We got the bill out earlier rather than later. I'm aware of that pressure and we'll do my best to do that. Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? So Representative Neuberger renews his motion to have House File 2817 laid over for possible inclusion as amended. But Representative Neuberger, on Wednesday, we're going to continue this conversation. With that, members, we are adjourned. Thank you.